Hello, Park Street. Welcome back to another episode. Today is day 26 of Lent, and I'm here recording with my friends Scott and Ann Williams. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Can you guys give, I've asked most people when they do their first episode to give a quick recap of how long they've been coming to Park Street and how they're involved in ministry around the church, so could you guys give a quick description of that for you guys?
Absolutely. Go ahead. You can go first.
I started attending at Park Street in 92 when my family moved here from Columbus, so I think 27 years. I've served in different roles over time, but right now I'm helping with the K-1 Sunday school on a rotation basis, so I like to hang out with the kids.
I've been in Ashland since I was around six, and then went to school to Ohio University for a couple of years. And then when I transferred back, I went to AU. And at that point, that's when I started coming to Park Street. So this is like in 2000. And then I had a job working at First United Methodist for a few years, and then came back. So I don't know. It depends on when you, 2000, or it was probably around 2004, 2003, do you think, Anne?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So I've been coming since then, and been involved in worship teams and those sort of things here.
Cool. I was thinking about you guys. Scott was one of my small group leaders probably when I was in high school, junior, senior year, along with Keith Gibson.
Yep, Keith Gibson. And it was, in the group was Paul Stover, yep. Joel Weidenhammer, J.D. West,
yeah.
You... Who is there anything else? Is that
I don't
it?
Know. I think it might have been just.
I think that was it. Yeah. That was a long time ago.
But I do remember those days of like. There's been, I guess, a handful of people in my life that like I look back and like, these people really, like at the beginning of the Book of John, there's a story we read in chapter one where like, somebody takes you to Jesus. Like there's like, John the Baptist has disciples, and then he takes them to Jesus, says, look, there's the Lamb of God, and he takes them to them, and then they start bringing their friends. I feel like in my life there's been people who have brought me to Jesus, and I feel like you and Keith were in that group of people.
That's cool.
That was like people that I liked and respected that were like, here's what it's like to become more like Jesus. So
yeah, that's cool. Yeah. And every person has those people in their lives.
So
It's cool to be that, because I've had those people, like John Swope was a massive one for
me. Yeah.
And he went Park Street for a long time, just finished up as an intern pastor over at Five Stones, but that guy is massively impactful, as well as like five other dudes,
Yeah.
So
Yeah, there's a lot of those people.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking about, as I was reflecting on kind of like our relationship over time, like I've known you guys for a long time, and
yeah.
It's cool.
That's awesome.
So thank you for taking some time to talk about this section of John. So our passage for today is John chapter 12, verse 37, and we're going to read through the end of the chapter, which is verse 50. So, Anne, can you read it?
Yep, I'm going to read. Even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs in their presence, they still would not believe him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet. Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For this reason they could not believe, because, as Isaiah says elsewhere, he has blinded their eyes and deadened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke out about him. Yet at the same time, many, even among the leaders, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not confess their faith for fear they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved praise from men more than praise from God. Then Jesus cried out, "When a man believes in me, he does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. When he looks at me, he sees the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. As for the person who hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge him. For I did not come to judge the world but to save it. There is a judge for the one who rejects me and does not accept my words. That very word which I spoke will condemn him at the last day. For I did not speak of my own accord, but the Father who sent me commanded me what to say and how to say it. I know that his command leads to eternal life, so whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say.
All right, thanks, Anne, for reading. there's some interesting, I guess, themes in this 13 or 14 verses. What are your thoughts on, it says, the passage starts off, it said, you know, despite everything Jesus did, most people still didn't believe. And then in verse 42, it says, many people did believe in him, however, including some of the Jewish leaders, but they wouldn't admit it for fear that the Pharisees would expel them from the synagogue. In your own, I guess in your own experience, have you found it difficult to believe or relatively plausible to believe, but more fearful of admitting it? Do you know what I'm saying? I think there's two groups of people in this passage where it's like, there's people who just said no, and then there were people that were like, yeah, this is probably true, but they didn't have the ability to really process that and be public about it.
Yeah, it's so tough because we live in such a different cultural time. Because back then, Jesus wasn't who Jesus is today in Ashland, Ohio, in 2,000 years later. You know, it's very easy now in this culture in Ashland to believe in it. But back then, it was fresh and it was new and it was difficult. So I don't know. I have a hard time like empathizing with that. You know, like the folks that, like where it talks about in the synagogues, that they love the synagogues and the praise of men more. That's difficult because I can imagine back then it was a brand new idea that, yeah, they believed in him, but also we have this entrenched thing that has been going on for so long that speaks into culture that it's really hard for that to not win out, I think, over time. So I can kind of see where that's coming from. But and you and I were kind of reviewing this, you were talking about like the interesting position of where this is in terms of like Jesus's ministry. Do you know what I mean?
I had read that John chapter 12 is the very end of his public ministry for 3 years, whereas chapter 13 begins like it's just like his private ministry with the disciples. Before his death. So this is like the very last thing that he says in his...
Yeah. So kind of almost... Public. Yeah, the way I think of it, kind of putting it into modern day times, it's a little bit like if we were to have followed Jesus today, like with all of the media that is out there, you know, like TV and doing live video and all that kind of stuff, that... These are the last words that he would be saying in that arena. Like, these are the last things that we would see him say on TV before he goes dark.
Yeah.
You know, before he comes, like, we don't hear a word from him. And I just think that the last thing is that he says to the entire world. I mean, obviously it's cataloged here so we know what happened after this. But in that moment, in that time, he didn't do feeding the 5,000 kind of things anymore, you know? After this passage, after these sentences, he now kind of goes a little, and this begins the beginning of the end. And this is where he says, so whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say.
Yeah.
That's the last sentence he says publicly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating, that he's aligning himself with the Father and reflecting all things back to him.
No, I like all the stuff you said there. If we saw a dude show up out of nowhere and start doing miracles and claiming to be God, you know, yeah. Like it's not normal, and it's not something you would, I think, just be like, oh yeah, of course, that's right. Totally true.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He didn't look the way people expected the Messiah to. I mean,
no,
he was totally countercultural yeah. from all that they had been waiting for all these years.
Yeah, who they're waiting for is a military leader. They're waiting for somebody to come in triumph and destroy Roman rule and establish a new kingdom here on earth. And that is not what Jesus was doing. Like, his kingdom was way different than what the Israelites had thought had been promised. You know,
yeah.
Like so much of culture and thought around what the Messiah would look like really tainted that view of what the Messiah actually was.
Yeah, in yesterday's episode, there Jesus comes into Jerusalem, and it's after he raises Lazarus from the dead. You know, he's, like you were saying, this section kind of concludes his public ministry. I mean, he's pretty much at the height of fame. You know, he's got people coming. It says in verse 20 of chapter 12 that the Greeks who had come to Jerusalem for the Passover visited Philip, and then they're trying to basically get him set up a meeting with Jesus so they can kind of hear what he has to say. You know, like people from all over, essentially the world, are here, you know, to talk to Jesus, and then he goes into this whole thing about how, you know, now it's time for me to die. And he gives them this whole sermon about, you know, I'm going to die, and that's what I'm about. And it's just kind of crazy that that's what he tells people who are, you know, looking for him to become, like you said, a military leader or to take over, you know, by force. It's a hard message to believe in some senses. I mean, it's a hard message to accept that a guy could actually do supernatural things. Like, that to me is hard to accept. I mean, I've never really seen... I mean, I've seen weird stuff happen. Like, I could give you stories about where I've seen, like, weird stuff happen where I know God was doing something that didn't make sense. But to see somebody, like, raise somebody from the dead or heal somebody who was totally sick, like, that's... There's always a way out, right? You can always kind of rationalize,
right.
Well, that just... Maybe that was something else, or maybe this was, you know... Couldn't really have been God who did that. You know, it's really tough to accept that Jesus is who he actually said he was, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't seem possible. And then he came to die, you know, at the end of this whole, you know, the life that he was living and the ministry he was doing. It just seems so weird and so not what you would expect, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The other thing that, I mean, jumps out to me, Ian and I were talking about this before, and I think you go through different seasons of life as a believer in Christ where things are more important and less important. But this, it's a really tough pill to read in 37 and 38, where even though he performed all these signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet. Lord, who has believed our message, and it's 39. For the reason they could not believe because of Isaiah says elsewhere, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes nor understand with their hearts nor turn, and I will heal them. And we were reading stuff by, was it Keller?
John Piper.
Yeah, John Piper, Desiring God,
mm-hmm.
where he was like reflecting on this. Do you want to talk about what?
No,
you can. I mean, he was just saying, you know, that even though, like, there is this passage that kind of seems that, you know, and this is the free will predestination thing, what is happening here? And, you know, when I was early in college, like, this was a big deal to me. And, you know,
yeah,
read through it and kind of, you know, just learned a lot about that arena. And now, I mean, I'm 40. You know, so twice the age, and this whole thing just doesn't seem as, there's more important things, I guess,
yeah.
At my point. However, these things are hard to kind of wrestle with when it comes to scripture. And, you know, there's the Romans passage where it talks about, I think it's, I'm going to butcher this, but it's like the potter and the clay and like the, he can kind of do whatever he wants. Like,
oh, right.
He's the creator, right?
Right.
And so, like, him hardening the hearts here, is that him doing that, or is that in because of the message, it's them who harden, actually do the hardening,
yeah.
But it's just hard for them. I don't know.
Like, how much is their responsibility,
yeah.
In their choice to believe in him?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think there's a ambiguity there that's just,
yeah.
Sits.
And I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah.
Like, I feel really comfortable with that now at my age. You know what,
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
Before, I felt very uncomfortable with it, but now I'm just okay. I'm okay. Like, I don't know the answer, and like, that's all right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And back in John chapter 10, when we were reading through, Jesus is talking about being the good shepherd and that his sheep know his voice and will listen to him. And throughout, I guess, chapters, like, let's say 6 through 10, he's really butting heads with the Pharisees. And in chapter 10, he basically says, like, my sheep listen to me. You know, kind of like, also, you don't. Yeah. You know, like, people have the ability to listen, like, listening to something versus not listening to something or ignoring something. And that's kind of, you know, in verse 37, it says, despite all the signs, right, people didn't believe.
Yeah.
And they had at some level of evidence, and they still kind of chose not to listen. The other thing that's interesting about the hardening of their hearts language, it reminds me of in Exodus when the Israelites are being led out of Egypt. You know, there's these, the plagues come, right? And so there's plague number one. Pharaoh decides, okay, you can go. And then there's like this language where like his heart becomes hardened, or God hardens his heart. And he says, no, you can't go. Plague number two, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All through plague number 10, you know, the killing of the first son of all the Egyptians and the original Passover, right? And then even after that, his heart is still, like, he relents, but then he keeps coming back. And I don't know that this is true, but I'm wondering, you know, when John uses language like that to people who are Jewish, they would have maybe associated with the fact that, like, these religious leaders and these people, that he's comparing them in some way to, like, to Pharaoh, like, that he was just unwilling. They were just, for whatever reason, you know, because of their own unbelief, like, their hearts became hard, which forced them to believe less, which means their hearts became hard. You know, it's like kind of starts this vicious cycle of, like,
And
once you choose into rejecting God, it becomes a cycle of, like, it gets worse and worse and worse, right? You can't, how do you get out of that?
Yeah.
It just reinforces itself.
So what's a modern day equivalent to that? I think that something around the political realm is really easy with this. Like, for example, it doesn't matter. And I'm not talking left or right. This actually applies to both. That if I say, hey, political figure A, like, do you follow that person? Do you trust that person or whatever? And they say yes. And then they've already made that micro decision, right? And so now that they've made that micro decision, it doesn't matter what evidence you introduce that counteracts that. They've already made that micro decision, and so they're going to reject anything that doesn't fall in line with their presuppositions, right?
Yeah.
And so we do this all the time. Like, we see things, like, there can be something that happens with Donald Trump. And if you like Donald Trump, you will see that he made a good decision. If you dislike Donald Trump, you will see that he made a poor decision. That evidence is always put through that filter.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And so in this way, it's the exact thing that's happening here is that, and even down into where they talk about in, what is it? Is it 42? But because of the Pharisees, they would not openly acknowledge their faith for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. That they may have had this inkling of, yes, this thing might be changing my mind, but this thing always grabs hold, this tradition, this thing that's longstanding.
Yeah.
And then up before where it's the hardening of hearts, it may be that they just can't quite make the switch to real, what's reality. And because they can't, it just continues to harden their own heart naturally.
Yeah. You're right. I like what you said. I mean, people are not naturally objective. We all have...
Nope.
We all have filters through which we view information. And those filters are usually good. I mean, I'm not saying that they're always bad. I mean, you can't... It takes too much energy and effort to view... To try to make yourself an unbiased observer over every little thing that happens to you. Like, the reason we develop these types of biases is because... Or stereotypes is because they generally prove to be helpful and somewhat true, right? But they're not usually 100% true.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to use them exclusively for really trying to evaluate the world because you might not be 100% correct. In fact, you're very likely not to be. So how are you able to check yourself on the things that you believe that aren't true, right? Like aren't real.
Yeah.
It's a hard question.
I mean,
and it's a very human problem.
It is a very human problem. Yeah, a couple things that come up with that makes me think of those things. One has to do with work, and I'd given a lot of thought to kind of scope of work that we were doing for a client at work, and I came into a conversation with this client with, hey, this is how we need to proceed forward, and that we, you know, what she was asking for was outside of the scope of work that we had talked about doing. And when we got there, I like to think of myself, nobody is purely objective, right? Nobody certainly is, but I fancy myself more objective than the next
more
person.
More rational than emotional. Yeah. Right.
Yes, exactly. Right. And so when we were talking and I said, it's outside of scope, here's how it works, blah, blah, blah. And she said, no, it doesn't work like that. Here's how it's to work. And just a moment, she's right. And so I said, you're right. And at this point, her emotions had elevated. And I was just like, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. So we'll do it your way. And she said, wait, what? And I said, no, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. She said, okay. And it was really kind of like, it kind of killed the conversation, you know, and then I had to get it back on track. But ultimately she appreciated that, but it's very difficult to do that. And we are actually just talking about this, like at dinner, you know, that like sometimes kids are like this, you know, that, that Esther, like our youngest, will sometimes question our choices, you know, like we'll say, no, you can't have that extra cookie. I don't know what it is or whatever. And she's like, why? Like what? But the reason is because I just said no. Like, well, that's a silly reason. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's actually, if I were to actually really be objective and say, why did I say no on this? You know, like,
right.
She hasn't had any sweets all day. She's been a very good girl. And like, all of the things would line up to me saying yes, but I actually said no. And so I tell her no, and then she calls into question my reasoning. Then I now feel, you know what? Like, I'm on the defensive now. And it's only because I've said no is that's really the only reason.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it tough, like, to kind of break out of this. And so maybe that's 10 minutes later, maybe that's what what's saying here with the hardening of the hearts. These little micro decisions that get spun out of control.
Mm.
No idea.
Well, but the reason that you have a default answer of no to Esther is because if your default answer was yes to everything she asked you,
the house would be burned down.
Right. Like,
yes.
you have very
we would
good,
have not have a house.
You have very good reasons for that, right?
Yes.
So it's like, that's the point, though, is that it's like, you say no because 8 out of 10 times it's just like, no, Esther, you can't do X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
That's never happening, whatever. But then the 2 times where it's like, oh, you know, I really should entertain this. She's right. You know, it's like, it's tough to evaluate all those things on a one-off basis because you just, there's 100 of those decisions in a day and you just want to try to figure it out, you know?
Yeah, and to that end, I mean, if we were to take the analogy, continue to take it to its nth degree, there are always claims to God. I mean, there's only one true God. That's it. But there were thousands. You know what I mean? There's been millions probably in the course of time. And only one of them's been right. You know? And so the default answer typically is, you're not God. You know? You're not God. You're not God. And so these rabbis who enjoyed the synagogue and had a rhythm and everything, this person comes through and has a claim on God. That's difficult to suss out that this one is actually true.
Yeah.
Out of the thousands or whatever that they've seen in their lifetimes that could have a claim, like have a claim on God.
Yeah.
That this one actually is different and it's real and it's reality. Nah, I'll just default back to what I know.
Yeah. One of the things I like though about this dynamic of, you know, group A didn't believe despite the miraculous signs. Group B did believe, but their belief was weak and it was tainted by their expectations. Like, I feel like it gives me an additional level of respect for Jesus that these are the groups of people that he's interacting with on a consistent daily basis, right? Like, that he's just like, okay, the people who are outright, your enemies that reject you and try to stop what you're doing, like, that's frustrating, right? Like, when people just openly oppose you. But even when your friends are, like, not really your friends, it's, like, it's kind of where, you know, like, there's a point to that, too, where it's, like, he gets it on both sides, and he's, like, you know, And he goes into this kind of these words about, you know, God sent me. I say what I'm supposed, you know, I say what I'm told, you know, I say what God tells me to say. And the results are, some people are going to hate me. Some people are going to believe me, but they still, they're just human beings and they're weak and they don't have the ability to actually really believe it. They know they believe it, but they can't actually let it affect their behavior because they have all these other biases. They're afraid of what other people think. That's me, man. Like, that is life, right? Yeah. Like, how many of us at Park Street are just like, we believe this stuff. Like, I believe that what Jesus said is true. And yet, you know, there's all these other factors that go into play that counteract that belief.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, dude, that's 100% true.
Yeah. And I mean, getting to the end of that, like, little bit there, like, kind of the big question that I think people need to ask is, what are those things in our life that we desire human praise more than praise from God? What is that thing that we're always thinking, man, I hope somebody sees what I'm doing here is really good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Did you guys see what I just did? You guys,
that's check this so out over here. That's so easy to do in the culture of media and just,
my goodness,
just everything. Of course. It's a hard thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that there was, I can't even recall who it was, but it was a social media, or I mean a YouTube, you know, YouTube star or whatever. And they, you know, took like $100 and went and bought a homeless person new shoes or something. And it was, you know, like a 2 or 3 minute video. But ultimately the backlash was, how are we even seeing this? Because ultimately, like, he saw an opportunity for a lot of views.
Right.
And he did this good thing, which is obviously great, you know, giving a homeless person new shoes. But it really speaks to the motivation that he wasn't actually doing it out of the kindness of his heart. It was rather, hey, I want to get the hundreds of thousands of views and likes on this thing. But the community saw through it.
Yeah.
And said, how in the world are we even seeing this, dude?
Right.
This feels like a production.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, that I've found personally is that's true. Like, at best, my motivations are mixed, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I do care about the homeless person that I'm buying new shoes. Of course. But I also care about getting credit.
Yep.
And it's, like, that's at best, and sometimes it's worse. But, like, even when you do have a pure motivation to do something, I found, like, it's always the next thought of, like, you do something that you feel like God wants you to do, and you don't want the credit. But then you're like, oh, sweet, I did it. I didn't want the credit. I should get credit for that. Like, it's always, like, right, it's, like,
it's
lurking.
Just hanging,
it
right
hangs
there.
Outside your entire, over our entire lives, you know, hangs this idea that, like, it's still just, like, what we want to be given, you know, praise. And it's interesting that, like, you know, John doesn't say, they love praise and you shouldn't love praise. It's just that they valued the resource
more,
of, the source of praise that was jacked up, right?
It was, like, out of balance.
Yeah. That, like, God gives us praise, right? Like, God is willing to praise us. He praised Christ, you know? And it's like, when we belong to him, we have a source of praise that is actually, you know, that can actually funnel us through this ridiculous absurdity of, like, trying to just garner credit and pick up quarters on the sidewalk anywhere we can, you know? It's like, but it's just so funny because it's such an unavoidable part to me of, like, just being a human being of, like, I always want praise. And people are the people, you know, everyone's around as a person. So it's like, I just try to get it from them instead of going directly to, you know, to God to get it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so funny because it's so true. You know, it keeps coming back. It's like, it just cycles back. Like, there's at the end of Super Mario Brothers on Nintendo. So the final Bowser that you have to beat, if you have to go down, like, the exact certain pipe, right? Like, you go through the level and you're beating everybody, and then there's a pipe you have to go through to actually trigger yourself to get through to fight the final Bowser. This is very, very practical
very
and important.
I love it.
What happens is, if you miss that pipe, you just keep cycling back through the level, and you keep doing the level over and over and over again until the time runs out, and you lose because you ran out of time.
Yeah.
And so the first however many times you play, this is pre-internet, right? So, like, 1992 Ryan.
You didn't know what was up.
I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then, like, all of a sudden, somehow I forget how it happens. It's probably luck or whatever. You go down this pipe and all of a sudden you realize, or one of your friends figures it out, right? Or they bought some cheap magazine at the park market.
Yeah.
And it's like,
the
I figured it out.
Oh my gosh,
dude. I figured it out. You know, I figured out how to get out of this cycle of repeating the same thing over and over again, right? And it's like, once you hit the right, like, you get through, all of a sudden you're not repeating the cycle. And it's like, there are these periods of time where you find, like, this relation to God where it's like, oh, dude, I finally got out of the whole self-promoting, like, trying to be getting credit thing. And it's like a second or two, and then you're back, kind of, right? But it does exist. It, like, it really does. Like, the pipe is real, and you can actually beat the final Bowser, so.
The thing that I love, two things that I love about that. Number one is, I don't think in the history of Christianity and Jesus that he's ever been compared to the correct pipe.
Super Mario Brothers.
In Super Mario Brothers to get to Bowser. That's number one. And number two, I love that's how this particular podcast is ending.
Yeah.
Like, I love that, that we started at this passage, and now we have brought it all the way back around to Super Mario Brothers.
Well, I appreciate you guys recording this one with me. Thank you for everybody who's listening. And tomorrow's episode, actually, is going to be fun, too. So you want to tune into that, because I recorded with Anne's dad, Dale Stouffer, and we're going to talk about John 13, which is a really good episode as well. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you tomorrow. Take care.